Hello, you're listening to The Joys of Teaching Literature. My name is Scott Cameron, and we're here talking about all things high school English. And so I'm assuming that you're on your summer break and everything is going smoothly. For me, it's not. I actually, in the late spring, I got into a bit of an accident playing soccer and had to get surgery. So that's it's kind of ruined my entire summer. I've been limping around the pool that I manage. And but hopefully you're having a good summer. And this is not a light topic, not a summertime topic, but it is something that I think is the source of a lot of people's frustration teaching. So it's good to think about it, I guess, in the what we'll call the off season, and that's plagiarism. So the title of this one's called How to Avoid Plagiarism and Cheating, 7 Tricks. Before I begin, if you'd like to know more about me, my website is www.theteachersworkshop.com. I offer online professional development for high school English teachers and for general education teachers as well. I have a second course that I just created that uses sports as a, ironically enough, I guess, uses sports as a metaphor for everything we do in the classroom, and sort of seeing how we can transfer some of that energy and enthusiasm for sports into teaching. Plagiarism. Yeah, it's one of those things, I think, no matter how many years you've been teaching, it affects everybody. I hear young teachers, new teachers complain about it. I hear teachers who've been there for 20, 30, 40 years complaining about it. It touches everybody. kids are not perfect, and so they make mistakes. There's a variety of different reasons why kids plagiarize, which I'll sort of go over. But I think I've over the years probably been less sort of emotionally impacted by cheating as far as getting upset about it. But it's still something that I think gets teachers upset for, there's a lot of different reasons why we can't stop and caring, really. Right. I think the first thing is that it's dishonest, obviously. It feels personal, like somehow there's this academic and kind of professional relationship we have with our students, and that makes us at least feel like there's this something personal going on, like a personal attack when they cheat in our class. Like it's not just the class, but us, right? The person. And then it also feels sort of a deliberate. Although I think that's probably the first thing to remember is that when a child cheats, it's not, I want to say not deliberate, because they definitely thought about doing it and did it. But I don't think they thought about it as much as we thought. We think that it's like this scheme or this game, when really it's just this passing thought, this thing that they did kind of quickly to solve a problem of a due date coming up that they forgot about, or just work that they didn't want to do. But it does feel like, I don't care about this assignment, and I don't care about you. So it definitely hurts. It's easy to forget why a student might cheat, and I think that's a difficult point, because we don't want to, sort of entertain excuses. We want there to be this sense of fairness that everybody has to do the same work. Why should one child, not be able to meet the expectation that everybody else should be able to meet? And again, it's that dishonesty factor. And I think it goes, but I do think that there's a lot of reasons why a kid might cheat, but I think that it's more than just gaining an unfair advantage. Sometimes that is what it is. They're obsessed with getting a good grade, and so they just cheat. And because they're out of fear of failure, out of fear of grade not reflecting their overall progress or overall grade in the class, or their fear of their parents, right? They get pressure from their community to be successful, perhaps. But obviously, parents are a big part there, right? If these parents see a zero, they know that screaming match is coming, right? Or that you're going to get grounded. They're not going to be able to go and see their friends over the weekend, whatever it might be. So they know there's consequences there. And they just don't want to face them. So it has nothing, sometimes has nothing to do with us. It has more to do with their parents. They might not understand the material. It's something that I think we sometimes just forget, that we some teach really difficult long novels. We should be teaching really difficult long novels. Not too difficult, but you know, we want to challenge them. And there's always a possibility that they just didn't get it. Faulkner, Morrison, Virginia Woolf, Ralph Ellison. You think about some of the writers that we teach. It's not exactly super easy. Even, you know, Husseini and some of the ones that are a little easier to read, the writing of Charles Dickens, for instance, is really easy to read. That's, you know, Great Expectations is 400 pages or something like that. So it's a matter of understanding and or just the magnitude of the task that could put them off. Perhaps they had some unexpected family trip or other responsibility get in the way of their work. They might be overwhelmed by due dates and projects and just couldn't keep track of it all. They could have been sick, right, recovering from illness, or sleep deprived. They just got a sort of bad week of sleep. They're teenagers. They're going through that adjustment. They're getting up early in the morning in a lot of cases. My school's starts a little bit later than most, but it's still pretty early. I think it's 8:20 we start. It used to be 7:50, which is even late for some schools. But you know, they're sleep deprived. They might have fallen behind not just in your class, but in all their other classes. So it's not even your class. It's, oh, I had this huge project, this huge test, and oh my gosh, right, I have this other quiz. What do I do about that? I have half an hour to figure out what to do about that, and you know, cheating and going online is the solution. You know, and let's not take that out of the equation here either. Some of these websites online are pretty helpful. They have really detailed summaries of the book. They have the themes. They have arguments about the book. They have quotes. There's a variety of different websites, not even just one or two. There's just a lot of, you know, and then not to mention the scholarly work that a student could find online if they want to dig that deep. There's just a ton of things online that weren't available to us as kids. So if we feel sort of like, oh my gosh, how could they do that? I mean, I had Cliff Notes. I'm showing my age here a little bit. But yeah, that's the one source that all teachers knew about. And so nobody really went there because it was the one place that, you know, you just shouldn't go. Sometimes kids did use it to help them understand, say, Faulkner or Shakespeare. But it wasn't something where you could just write an essay or turn in an assignment using that kind of material. You know, it's kind of begs the question, what kind of assignments are we giving that where they can take online work and have it even resemble what we expect them to do? So that's obviously part of it too. The temptation to cheat is probably more intense than it was when, you know, even 20, 30 years ago. Or even less. And then there's the feeling that catching up might take too much time, you know, or effort and time. It's like, okay, so I knew I didn't do this work. I got a week before the due date, but what do I have to do? Oh, right, I have to read a 300-page novel. Okay, well, that's not going to happen, right? I can't read 300 pages in a week, so what am I going to do? Well, I'm going to ask my friend for their work, right? Or this happens with cheating, too, is it's not even the one child that cheats, it's the fact that, you know, their friend pressured them into giving them the work, which is, you know, it's cheating too. But you know, that's a shame when a kid does do the work, right? Say, keep using the novel example, but say it's a couple of chapters in a history book or whatever it is. They actually did do the reading, they did do the work, and they just gave it to somebody else because, yeah, well, let's get into the mind of a teenager. It's, again, it's easy to get upset and get angry and be disappointed in kids, but they might not have friends. You know, these kids, a lot of kids are quiet. You know, they don't play sports. They don't have activities. They kind of just go about their day. And they might have a couple of friends. But I know there's a lot of kids that, you know, I see it all the time where I see kids in the hallway during our lunch period, the whole school is on break. And I see it all the time where I see kids eating by themselves. It just makes me so sad. But that's, you know, unfortunate reality. A kid might not have friends, and there's this kid that they're sort of friends with, and they're cool, and they ask them for the work, and they feel like, well, maybe I'll be cool if I give them the work. right? You got to go back to those days of being 15, 16 years old and not having a backbone yet. And this is what we're trying to teach them, is to have a backbone and not succumb to peer pressure. But that these are lessons that they have to learn. And we have to let them fail at life in order to learn those lessons. So it's, in a way, it's okay. You know, when they cheat, it's another lesson they're going to learn. They're going to get caught doing it. They're going to feel bad about it. And it's going to affect their grade temporarily, but it's just a part of the learning process. So that they don't go off to college and do it, and they don't go off to Wall Street, and they don't go off and get involved in fraud and right, all the different crimes that are basically cheating. You know? And we don't want them to be cheaters in the real world. So we want them to sort of understand why it's not right, not just, okay, here's your consequence, and that's part of it, of course, is making them know that there is a consequence, because in real world, obviously there's a consequence, college is a consequence, so we want to make sure that they understand that that's how things work, that there's consequences, but we also want them to give them the opportunity to learn from their mistakes and not crush them, because they made a mistake. We also live in a world now, again, sort of dating myself, where I sat in class and just listened to my teacher's lecture for the most part, which I enjoyed. I take notes, listen to him talk. Of course, they answered some asked questions people would answer. But the collaborative learning environment that we have today, where you work with one person, you work with six people, and you're doing it all the time, for some assignments, it might not be clear. Like, oh yeah, you weren't supposed to do that with somebody else. That was an independent project. I'm sitting here giving all these excuses. Kids get lazy. They just don't feel like doing the work, and they want the grade. They want to pass, and they get lazy, and that's simple as that, right? So it can be complicated reasons, but it also can be kind of simple too. It's pretty much 100% chance that you're going to have a student who cheats or plagiarizes. So I got seven ways to kind of deal with this. So the first one is talk about the value and of creativity and independent thinking early in the year. So this is really important, because this is, again, it's the learning process. It's not, don't do this because it's wrong. That's not, kids want to know why it's wrong, right? And so we have to sort of take it from the opposite approach here, from the opposite angle. Not just say bad, 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 this is so bad, right? Because that's going to probably make them want to do it even more. But it's like, what are we doing here? Well, we're thinking about becoming creative thinkers and independent thinkers. That's what we want. So plagiarism flies in the face of that. It's the opposite of creativity. It's the opposite of thinking for yourself. You're literally taking somebody else's words or somebody else's work and saying that it's yours. So you're doing that's basically opposite of what education is all about. In the beginning of the year, when I describe my assignments, it's in that context of what is an education all about. What's our objective here? And that's what it is. It's to sort of learn what other people say, but then go out into the world and make something new, that you can claim as your own, because you learned from that person, thought about it, and said something better as a result. Right, and so that's having that conversation is really important. I have a bunch of quotes that are really sort of inspiring quotes about literature and what it is that we're doing in class. But even when I talk about note taking and sort of broad thing that we're kind of doing all of the time in our classes, right? We're gathering evidence to help us study. But when I describe note taking and what we do in class, I try to emphasize that's what it's about. It's about listening. It's about reading. But it's really about learning how to think and having a document that shows that you're thinking, not just that you're listening and writing words down that somebody's saying. If you're listening to a lecture or you're in a conversation with somebody and you're just writing things down, you're not just writing what they're saying down, you're writing down what you think about what they're saying. You're doing a little bit of both, right? You might be quoting what they're saying, or if you're reading something, you might be quoting the text, but you're also thinking about what you're reading, processing it, making sense of it, and organizing it in a way that gives birth to its meaning, right? So we're sort of meaning making here, and that's something that students, I think, want to do. They go to school to find the meaning of things and to find something that they're passionate about and a direction that they can take in life that's going to provide them with fulfillment and satisfaction, that quest for meaning and that longing for meaning and something real, something authentic, is an important part of the educational journey. Students should listen, right? First, they should listen, then they should think, and then they should write. That's the sort of process of education, right? Is that you take it in, then you let your mind work a little bit, and then you write something down. Of course, you can say something as well, too. The notes become the foundation for what they will study and what they will express on paper or out loud. And so that's the sort of other element of writing, is that sometimes we write, but then we say something out loud. And that's an important part of being a citizen and, you know, human being and, you know, husband or friend or whatever, just a person in the world who says what's on their mind in a way that's considerate and kind and thoughtful. And that's really what we're doing when we give kids an education, is that we want them to be, you know, very much a part of, you know, the direction that their lives take, and thinking about that. And plagiarism is, we have to sort of present it as the sort of opposite. It's not even that we're mentioning plagiarism in these conversations, right? But if we focus on having some of these conversations early in the year about what it is we're doing, plagiarism, you know, unconsciously sort of flies in the face of all that. Students learn about the world as it is and then imagine what's next. And so if they're excited to be a part of that process, they're not going to plagiarize. If they're excited about what they're learning, they're not going to plagiarize. So that's an important part of what we do too, is like, how can we make this more exciting and really express our passion for what we do, whatever subject it is we teach. So that's, I think, important part of that. And if, you know, there, I think like what I said in the beginning, it does feel personal. And that's, I think, the thing that, you know, is a problematic for teachers, is that there's a tiny slither of truth there, that they're cheating because it has a little bit of something to do with us. They feel like our class is busy work, or they feel like, oh, this assignment is not really going to help me become wise or a better person or know about how the world works. But if we're doing our best to convince them that is exactly what we're doing. Again, it's from the beginning of the year, but throughout the year, if we're convincing them that the material that they're learning is going to help the world, not just them, but everybody, that's an important part of combating plagiarism. Two is give students enough time. And over the years, I've realized, it's like, oh, I got some cheaters here, an abnormal amount of cheaters here, because I just didn't give enough time. They shouldn't be rushed through the material they need to learn. They should be able to slowly digest the words, equations, historical events, and formulas. We don't watch a movie at twice the speed, right? You know, you can do that, where you sort of speed through the YouTube video or the TED Talk just to get the gist of what happened. You know, we're not in law school here, right? We want them to enjoy and slowly consume the material, and not just kind of rush through it. There's going to be no comprehension if they do that. And there's going to be no passion. There's going to be no interest. There's no emotional attachment to what it is they're doing if they just have to speed through it for the sake of speed, and that's it. We have to hit this. We have to do this. We have to do this, right? So they're going to quickly say, all right, well, I'm just going to cheat and move on, and I have to keep up with the speed of this class. We're not interested in the grade. When we watch a movie, right, we're not interested in a grade, right, or how well we comprehended things. We just want to interpret what we see and feel what we see, right, when we watch a movie. So we want school to be like that too. And just because, you know, this is another problem, right, is that we always have students that can keep up with the class, you know, but just because five students can complete all of the work, 100% of the work, by the due date, doesn't mean all of our students can. So, yeah, just because Charlie can doesn't mean everybody else can. And I think that's what I immediately go to, is like, well, all these other kids did it, why can't you do it? Well, there's I went over the reasons, but there are probably reasons why they can't do it, because they're an individual person, and not all your students are the same, right? It's important to cater to all of our students and not just a small minority. It's not easy, but there is a timeline that works for everyone. And getting that right is extremely difficult, but it takes a lot of flexibility and trying different things. Sometimes it's as easy as asking, right? Just ask your students, how much time do you need? And again, it's just adjusting it and pushing due dates back when you know things are going on you know, like AP, you know, exams or, you know, college, you know, application due dates and all that kind of stuff that gets in the way of things. It's okay to be, to, you know, push things back sometimes. Not a disaster. Number three is give students the opportunity in class to gather evidence and collaborate. And the emphasis here is in class. You know, if we're sort of wondering why they cheated, it's probably because we might have given them a lot of work to take home. You know, if a student has a bunch of pages of notes before they take a test or write an essay, they will be confident and ready to perform because they've done the necessary intellectual legwork required for success. If teachers give students time in class to complete the work, there's no excuse because we did it in class. You know, and that's a bare minimum expectation for success, is that you go to class. That's not always easy either to get kids to go to class, but at least if they show up, you know, you're giving them the opportunity to get the work done in class and not at home. You know, if you do send it home, then again, we're going to sort of go through a whole nother slew of reasons why they're not doing stuff. They go to play sports and they're tired from playing sports. They got to eat, sometimes have really long dinners with their family. They have extracurricular activities. They have work to complete in other classes. You know, and I think we always think that our class is the most important thing in their entire life, and how dare you didn't meet that one due date. They have a million things going on sometimes. They got to walk the dog. They got to take care of their younger siblings before their parents get home from work, which is sometimes really late. They might have to make their own dinner, healthy or not, right? That's going to affect whether they're able to be focused and, you know, pay attention late at night when they're supposed to be doing their homework. They may face distractions that come from being in a big family in a small home, from parents that fight. You know, that's a huge distraction. Siblings that bully them, give them a hard time about different things. They may have to work a job to help their family make ends meet. They could be battling depression or anxiety. They might not have a quiet space to work, or they have to work in their bedroom, which is never good, right? Because it makes you kind of sleepy and tired. Some studies that showed that. That's where I think most of students I think in the country are probably just doing work in their bedroom, which is not good for their sleep and it's not good for their work, right? It's a double whammy. So right there is a good reason to not assign too much homework. And then of course there's the huge powerhouses of TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Candy Crush, or whatever game they have on their phone. All this stuff is designed to make our students addicted to them and want more and more and more and more and more. And they're victims. They're victims of that. And we can blame them and say you have to take personal responsibility, but they are kids. They're children. And these apps and algorithms are very, very powerful. And it takes them away from their work. And they got their phone in their pocket while they're doing work, so they're not focused. They're not spending long amounts of time on the homework that they have. Because their parents are not saying, you know, put your phone out here, or willing to have that battle because they're addicted and they're putting up a fight about it, right? So these are all problems with sending work home. Or, you know, maybe they're like us and they're old school. They have long, meaningful conversations about the scheme of things over the phone with their friends. You know, I sort of talking about my childhood there a little bit. I had friends where I would just kind of spend hours and hours on the phone, and because I didn't want to do my homework. But, you know, I learned a lot in those conversations. We figured out the world and laughed about our lives. And, you know, I'm digressing now, but, you know, dare I say, students should learn at school and not at home. So that's number three. Number four, ask students to create original prompts. So the more that we put them in the driver's seat and say, you tell me what you want to do and what you want to learn about, obviously then they're going to be less likely to plagiarize, right? Students might be tempted to plagiarize or cheat because they know that every other student in their class has to answer the same exact question. If students work with their teachers to create their own questions, they will feel like no one else has the answer and that it's up to them to solve the puzzle. Of course, there's value to asking all students one question and expecting a response by the end of the class using nothing but paper and a pencil. That's tremendous value to that. That question that we ask the same question of all our students, you know, it should be big enough so that everyone can answer it, but challenging enough for the students that want to go above and beyond. So it's not about doing one single thing all year long, right? It's about where sometimes we're going to take a pencil and paper out and write an essay, and how can you cheat when you just have a paper and pencil? But sometimes you're going to go online, and in that case, if you're going online and finding your own resources, and you're going to make up a topic that only you are going to write on, obviously makes it a little bit harder to cheat. Of course, there's all those resources online I talked about, but if it's something that they want to write about, then it's a little bit less likely that they're going to cheat. Five is work with students to plan ideas. So once a student picks their own topic, teachers can incrementally work with students to develop a plan of action that will put them on the path to success. It's impossible to plagiarize a conversation, and a good exchange of ideas reduces the desire to look for good ideas elsewhere on the internet. So that's kind of what I'm mentioning when we conference with students. We're sort of going back and forth with what their ideas are and what approach they can take, and it gives them a little bit of confidence, and they're hearing their teacher sort of, yeah, that's a good idea. Why don't you talk about this, or did you think about that? That sort of thing. So they're less likely to just fear that, they're not going to get the right answer by writing a certain thing about a certain novel or whatever it is. But instead they're getting feedback in real time, and they feel confident about what they're doing. Six is use or don't use online tools like Turnitin.com and Google Drive, that allows teachers to monitor the revision history of any student. Of course, I'm sure everybody knows about Turnitin.com. It basically checks one student's work against a huge database of online websites and other student work. But there's always a way around whatever method we think up to catch plagiarizers. I'm amazed at the ways that they figure out how to get around the system. I remember one year I figured out that Turnitin.com doesn't include SparkNotes in its database. SparkNotes is something you can Google, and it doesn't take that into account. So when I collected this one assignment, it didn't show up on Turnitin.com. I'm like, but this is from SparkNotes. Yeah, everybody knows the language. If you're an English teacher, especially, you know the language of SparkNotes. And I just read it, and I was like, all right. So yeah, there's always something, right? Online plagiarism checks feel like a preemptive gotcha, right? Before you even submit, you're basically saying to your kids, I already think you're going to cheat, and I'm ready to play this game with you. So I go back and forth with that one. It's much easier to say, this machine said you cheated, not me, right? And so that kind of takes that personal, whatever is going on there when a child cheats, kind of takes that out of there, because you're like, this website's saying you cheated. Look, it's right there. It's giving me the source and all that. So it's something you can kind of move on a little bit quickly. But seven is don't overreact to cheating, but have consequences. So it's really hard not to care when someone cheats in my class. Part of me feels like they did something wrong, and part of me feels like I did something wrong. It's worth the conversation, especially if the student genuinely wants to explain what happened. Regardless, teachers have to prioritize fairness, which ultimately means that there should be some kind of consequence for cheating and plagiarism, especially for repeat offenders. In the end, people are allowed to make mistakes, especially children. Thanks for listening.